Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Opioids are powerful drugs that can help people who are struggling with pain from severe injuries or illness. But the compounds are also highly addictive, and the CDC says overdose is one of the leading causes of injury death for adults in the U.S., with rates quickly climbing from the early 2000s. In recent years, overdose deaths have declined in most of the country, but remain high in Alaska. Why are rates still elevated here, and what is being done to help people stay safe from illicit drugs? We'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Far too many people have become trapped in addiction after developing dependence on drugs that were designed to alleviate pain and were prescribed by doctors to aid healing. As more information becomes available about how powerfully addictive opioids such as OxyContin are, people who would have never imagined taking illegal drugs found themselves turning to street drugs after losing access to prescriptions, and over the last two decades, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died from opioid overdose. Fentanyl and carfentanil are particularly lethal. Overcoming addiction is difficult, but it is possible, and there are many ways to achieve sobriety and stay on a healthy path for the future. People make that choice every day. The Alaskans with us today work hard to assist people in recovery as they try to help prevent death from addiction and overdose. Dr. Sarah Spencer works to help people struggling with heroin or other opioid addiction with medicine-assisted therapy. We'll learn more about that. Sandy Snodgrass is in the studio with me today. Sandy is an anti-opioid activist who tragically lost her son to overdose. And Sandy now works to help others stay safe from these lethal drugs through education and getting Narcan, a life-saving anti-overdose treatment, into the hands of Alaskans across the state. And on the line with us is Michael Carson. Michael is a recovery specialist at My House of Mat-Su and chair of the Mat-Su Opioid Task Force. Welcome, all of you. Thanks so much for being on hand today for this discussion. Dr. Spencer, start us off here. How long have you done this work, and what have you seen in the rates of addiction and overdose deaths in that time?
So I started doing this work when I first moved to Alaska 16 years ago, which I spent the first 4 or 5 years in Valdez and then moved to the southern Kenai Peninsula. And, opioid use disorder has been a problem in Alaska and statewide that entire time. And Alaska really reflects a lot of the trends we see nationwide, and that we really saw every year the rates of opioid use disorder and deaths related to opioid overdose kind of climb significantly every year until really just recently, this last year or so, we're beginning to see hopefully a trend in plateauing or declining. But we're behind the nation in that, in kind of seeing the progress towards reducing deaths related to opioid use disorder here in Alaska.
All right. Thank you for starting us off. Sandy, I want to turn to you now. I'm so sorry that your son is gone. Whenever I think about you and the work that you do, my heart hurts for you and your loss. Your son Bruce was an avid outdoorsman and a wilderness EMT. When did he first start struggling with drug use?
So Bruce got his wisdom teeth out when he was 17 and was prescribed OxyContin at that time. And I administered those pills to my son. I'm a clinician, so I know the dangers of substance use disorder. We have it in both sides of his family. He knew the dangers of substance use disorder, but I did give him those pills, and something in him triggered with that prescription of oxycodone, and I never got my son back after that.
Just so, so terrible and tragic. We'll talk more about your work as we go through the hour here. I want to turn to Michael now for a moment. Michael, you sent email early this morning about a few things, including International Overdose Awareness Day on August 31st. Talk about what you're seeing in the Matsu region for rates of addiction and overdose, and how you feel are you making progress with your current programs?
Well, first, I want to thank God for naloxone. It has saved many, many Alaskan lives. And if anyone listening would like to be able to have and carry Narcan, with naloxone, the active ingredient, you can call Project Hope with Tim Easterly at 907-334-2675. And also, Lori, they have medication disposable bags that you can dispose safely of any kind of pills or liquids. It has a charcoal filter in it, put water in it, and then it can be disposed safely. So by getting naloxone out in those medicated disposable bags, we can save lives, and that's first and foremost. And then hopefully those individuals decide to get into treatment. And there are many, many treatment options available in Alaska, and a person can go to Alaska211.org, and there is multiple treatment options available for people that are seeking help. Mm-hmm. So that is, and then also this month is National Recovery Month. I want to thank the governor for putting out that proclamation, and Alaskans can and do recover, and it is possible.
Absolutely. Michael, tell us a little bit about the programs at My House.
My House, we service youth that are experiencing homelessness. We have launched a 3.1 treatment program. We have wraparound services. We have housing. We provide case management. And even though we have housing is not our solution. We believe job training and employment is the solution to homelessness. So we have wraparound services. We provide laundry. We provide showers, food every day at a 3 o'clock supper club. The door is always open. And we invite anyone that might be experiencing homelessness, if they want to flip that script, to be able to step into My House, and we can provide those services for them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for laying that out for us. Turning to all of you now, and maybe Sandy, you could start us off, and then we'll go to Dr. Spencer. Do you think addiction rates or illegal drug trafficking has changed since cannabis was legalized here? And if so, what have you observed in that regard?
I do think it's changed. So the legalization of marijuana has changed the landscape of people in Alaska and around the country to believe that marijuana is not addictive, that it is safe. And I don't believe that it is safe. I don't believe that it is non-addictive. I have contact with people in Narcotics Anonymous and people that say their drug of choice is marijuana, and they are addicted to marijuana. They believe they are physically addicted to marijuana. And I also think it's a gateway for young people. Many young people report starting with marijuana and ending many times, unfortunately, in death with other illicit drugs that are contaminated by fentanyl.
Dr. Spencer, your thoughts in this regard, and have you seen a change in the amount of use since legalization?
Correlation and causation are two very different things. And so it's really important to not get caught up in like, oh, around the same timeline. We see one thing happen, and does that mean that caused it? So nicotine, tobacco. almost every single person who develops an addiction, their first addiction is tobacco. So that is also the number one cause of loss of life is tobacco. And when we look in the long term, so we should not forget how important that is. Cannabis definitely has health risk associated to it. I think what we've seen with cannabis being legalized nationwide, and there's lots of new data on this, is we do see nationwide increased risk of cannabis use disorder, increased risk of ER visits related to cannabis, increased risk of, even though it's uncommon, risk of triggering problems with like schizophrenia in young people who are vulnerable to that already. When we look at how cannabis use disorder and opioid use disorder linked together, it's really hard to draw those correlations. And there's been a lot of different things over the last 10 years that, you know, sometimes we've seen some news stories saying, oh, look, with cannabis has been medical cannabis has been legalized in certain states, we look like we see a reduction in overdose rates. So maybe people are not using so many opioids and they're using cannabis instead for that pain. Maybe that's safer. And then some of those studies have been debunked. You know, again, it's causation, it's, correlation, not causation.
Oh, we're losing you, Dr. Spencer.
Yeah. area with a bit.
Your reception's a little bad right now. Michael, let's turn to you. What have you observed in the time since legalization has been in place?
I think there is an unfortunate misconception with youth that since it's legal, they think that they can obtain it legally. And we have to remind youth that, like alcohol, you have to be over 21. My concern with the current marijuana that is being retailed is such high potency. This is not the marijuana that, you know, our grandparents used in the 60s, which I am a grandparent and was part of that 60s. But we're talking about high potency levels. And then, unfortunately, there are individuals that are dabbing it, and that's when they take a small butane torch. And what they do is they heat up that marijuana bud and crystallize it, and it really doubles or triples the potency of it. And as Dr. Spencer mentioned, there has been cases of young youth that have been using that high-potency marijuana and slipping into a psychosis, schizophrenia, because of some latency mental health issues. I'm always remembered what Dr. Jay Butler says, who is the former medical officer for the state. Even though something is natural, that doesn't mean it's safe. And I think that's a real important message for youth.
Yeah, it definitely is an important message. There are a lot of naturally occurring compounds that are quite lethal, as we well know. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing fighting opioid addiction and overdose. We have on the line with us Dr. Sarah Spencer, an addiction medicine specialist who works for the Nanilchik Traditional Council. In the studio with me today is Sandy Snodgrass. Sandy is a therapist, a clinician, and anti-opioid activist. And on the line from the Valley is Michael Carson. Michael is a recovery specialist at My House of Mat-Su and chair of the Mat-Su Opioid Task Force. Dr. Spencer, let's see if your connection is working well again here. You were recently featured in reporting by Alaska Public Media's health reporter Rachel Cassandra. You have a mobile clinic, you're in that right now, and supply treatments such as buprenorphine. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Tell us what that treatment does for someone addicted to opioids.
What was that last question?
Is it buprenorphine?
Buprenorphine, yes.
I'm sorry. Yes. I'm trying to pronounce it correctly. Tell us about that treatment and what it does to help someone who is addicted to opioids.
Yeah, so buprenorphine has been being used for more than 20 years to treat opioid addiction, and it's really interesting. It's actually a partial opioid itself, but it's also an opioid blocker, and so it is tremendously effective in helping people to control their withdrawal symptoms and their cravings, to dramatically reduce or stop opioid use, and it also helps to prevent mortality, which is the most important thing it does. So it reduces the risk of dying from opioid use disorder by more than 60%. There's very few medications in modern medicine that reduce the risk of dying to that extent. And this medication, unlike methadone, where you have to go to a methadone clinic every day, you have to live in a city like generally like Anchorage to access that, buprenorphine can be accessed at any medical provider's office, any doctor's or nurse practitioner's office. So it really makes that more widely available. And the formulation that we use, for example, in our mobile clinic is a monthly injection of buprenorphine. So we give people a shot every month, and that helps them to control their cravings, use less, stop using, and then hopefully prevent them from dying. And it blocks, if people do use, it helps to block the effects of the fentanyl or the heroin.
The Department of Corrections has limits on who can access treatment while incarcerated, especially if they test positive for illicit drugs. You said you called that a huge missed opportunity and likened it to denying someone insulin for diabetes just because they ate a candy bar. What do you want to see happen for treatment of people who are locked up?
So I would like to see Alaska move towards the model like we're seeing in states like Rhode Island started in 2017, which is universal access to this medication for opioid use disorder, which is the gold standard treatment recommended by every single medical organization and has been for many years. And so, for example, in Rhode Island, when a person is incarcerated, they find out if they have a problem with opioids. And if they do, they offer them medication and they can choose from any of the three medications, naltrexone, buprenorphine, or methadone. They treat them the entire time they're there and then connect them to treatment when they leave. And that really is standard of care in medicine and should be standard of care in corrections. And that has dramatically, the first year that they did that in Rhode Island, they saw that people leaving incarceration, their rates of death were cut more than in half. And it actually caused the entire statewide overdose death rate to go down by almost 20%, 17% in the first year. So we know, and it also showed that it did not increase the cost as well. And so, you know, Alaska is kind of behind the times in that they're trying to do the bare minimum they can do to not to meet the Americans with Disability Act, which says if someone is in treatment and in recovery and not using opioids when they come in, you should continue their medication. But they're not offering it to people who are struggling, who are actively using drugs. Maybe they went off their medication or they're not on any medication at all. Those people are not offered medication. Those people are needed at least as much or more than the people who are on the medication. You know, they're at very high risk of death. When you leave incarceration, the risk of dying, studies in Washington, for example, show the risk of dying is over 100-fold higher when you're released from incarceration than the general population, because people lose their tolerance and without being on medication to keep them safe, go right back to using. So, and Alaska, is dealing with, first of all, trying to meet the bare minimum ADA requirements and not and keeping people on their medication and continuing it. But I think, you know, they're working towards moving towards offering treatment for everyone, but they're definitely not doing that yet, except for pregnant women. So, it's something that, you know, we see all these problems with incarceration too, with like the black market in the prison system of people smuggling in these medications or smuggling in drugs because they can't get the medication while they're incarcerated. So, and you know, the other thing is like doing these drug tests, like, you know, probation officers and things testing people, and they're positive for fentanyl. Well, if you stop using fentanyl, you can test positive for fentanyl for 2 or 3 months after you stop. So just because a person tests positive for fentanyl when they come in, but they're also on their medication, doesn't actually mean that they're using fentanyl. So they have people who aren't trained to interpret these drug tests, interpreting them, and then withholding a life-saving medication. The death from overdose skyrockets when you take someone off of their medication. So, you know, this is a very critically important life-saving medication. And Alaska's in trouble right now. They're getting sued for their issues related to medical care when people are incarcerated. And this is one of the issues that they're getting sued for by the Alaska ACLU. So I would love to see Alaska follow other states in the nation that have been doing this for years now and have shown that it's safe, effective, it doesn't cost any more money, and it saves a lot of lives.
We had a question by email from Kathleen, who writes, do you see the ultimate goal of treatment as keeping people on medications, she says, like Suboxone, long-term, or helping them taper off entirely? And how does harm reduction like syringes or fentanyl test strips fit into that vision? So what are your thoughts there about, should people gradually wean themselves off of these drugs, or how do you see that, Dr. Mm-hmm. Spencer?
So I think when we think of addiction as a chronic disease, and we should treat it like we treat every chronic disease. So when I think of, you know, what is my goal when I'm treating someone who has heart disease? It's hopefully that they don't have a heart attack, you know, that they don't become hospitalized, that they don't need to have heart surgery, that they have a good quality of life, that they can go for a walk with their kids and not have chest pain. When someone has diabetes, I don't want them to lose their eyesight, have a foot cut off, you know, be on dialysis. So we're the issue is not, are they on medication for the rest of their life or not? That's not the issue. We want to give them whatever treatment provides them the best quality of life and helps them to keep safe, healthy, happy life and keep them alive. So we know when people are on medication for opioid use disorder, again, it cuts their risk of dying in half. But when you take the medication away, that benefit is gone. And so we know people who are on, the longer people are on medication, the lower the risk of relapse goes. But even if we look at 5 years out, people who stay on medication are still twice as likely to stay in recovery than people who do not take medication. So there's no end of the benefit to this medication. It's always up to the patient. So there's no goal with the medication. There's no goal on, like, you must be on this for the rest of your life or you must stop this after a certain period of time. It's how are you doing? What is your function? What is your social situation like? Are you benefiting from the medication? Is it helping you? Do you want to continue it? Then yes, you should continue it as long as it is helping you to have a happy, healthy life. But the real struggle is trying to get people access to this medication, because the vast majority of people don't stay on the medication long enough. Most people need to stay on it for at least a couple years minimum. And it's a real struggle just to get people to stay on it even for 6 months. But we know if people stop medication in the first month, in the first year, like almost 90% of the people are going to go back to using before the year is up. And a lot of those people, unfortunately, are going to die of overdose when they go back to using. So the goal is not how long do you stay on medication or not stay on medication. The goal is how do I help that individual person have a happy, healthy, long life. And most of the time, that includes the long-term use of medication.
All right. Thank you for describing that course of treatment and how you see the longer-term implications of it. Sandy, I want to turn to you. There is a new short documentary that you helped get produced. It's called Poison in Alaska, Illicit Fentanyl in the 907. Let's hear a clip from it now. This is Jack Carson, a captain with the Anchorage Police Department.
In 2023, statewide, we had almost 2,000 overdoses recorded in the state of Alaska. Those are the ones that are actually reported. Out of that, about 1,200 of them in Anchorage alone, just our city here in Anchorage. Out of those 2,000 statewide, about 340 of those were fatal. And within Anchorage, about 220 of them are fatal. Those are not just the person out on the street, living homeless, chronically addicted to drugs. Those are kids, those are mothers, those are fathers, those are brothers, those are sisters. These are people that are dying. The drug is indiscriminate in who it kills.
A powerful, true statement, indiscriminate in who it kills. Do you think there's still too much stigma about who gets trapped in addiction that makes people dismissive because there's a sentiment of, well, you shouldn't use these drugs? The old just say no thought process. It's not that easy, right, Sandy?
I agree. And that's one of the reasons it's called Poison in Alaska. It's not called Fentanyl Alaska. All illicit drugs have to be assumed to have enough fentanyl in it to kill you. And young people, particularly, that have no idea the drug that they're taking is contaminated by fentanyl, that in my mind is a poisoning. And the people that are dying, unfortunately, the fastest growing demographic is 14 to 25 year olds in Anchorage. Those are young people that are not trapped in addiction. Those are people that are experimenting and are unaware, most of the time unaware, that fentanyl is in the drugs supply in Alaska as widely as it is. And AK Fentanyl Response, that's really what the message that I want to get out is to young people, that it's 100% preventable. Death from fentanyl is 100% preventable. If you never take an illicit drug, you'll never die from illicit drug.
How did this film get developed and when will it be released?
So the premiere on the YouTube channel of Texas Pictures, who is the producer, premiered it last Saturday. So it's available on YouTube, on my site, AK Fentanyl Response. So it's the film that I will use moving forward in communities and in schools to ultimately reduce demand. So that's kind of my lane, is demand reduction, because of the dangers of the drug supply in Alaska and the country.
And before we take a break, Sandy, I know you've worked all over the state with state troopers and others to help spread the word about Narcan and have taken kits to communities statewide. What do you want people to know about the safe administering of Narcan? I know that when I got kits myself, my partner said, you better be careful. What if you give it to somebody and they have a heart attack, or you give it to the wrong person? And I said, it can't hurt you, but flesh that out a bit.
So the only thing naloxone does is reverse an opioid poisoning, and it cannot, even in high doses, cause any harm to someone. We have the Good Samaritan Law in Alaska, which protects people to be able to help someone that they run across that they think may be suffering from an opioid poisoning. So do it rather than not do it, just in case. If the person has had a heart attack or any other kind of medical emergency, then naloxone will not harm them.
I was in reviewing the short documentary that you shared with us, one of the people that was featured in there talked about how you can tell if somebody has experienced an opioid overdose when you give them Narcan, naloxone, by how quickly they respond. I had that same experience I shared before we went live about giving Narcan to someone and having them respond within about 6 or 7 seconds. It was pretty startling how quickly the person became responsive and then started talking with us. So it is quite effective and very quickly effective.
It absolutely is. I've done the same. I've successfully reversed someone from a fentanyl poisoning in Washington, D.C. So everyone should have it, just like everyone has a first aid kit in Alaska. Every building has first aid kits. Anywhere where there's a fire extinguisher, I would like there to be a naloxone kit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, we're going to talk more about that and about how people can get Narcan kits, and we will continue our conversation after we take a break, and Talk of Alaska will continue statewide. So, Sandy and Dr. Spencer, I think it's hard for people who are not addicted to understand why anyone would try scary drugs. Sandy, if you say to someone, here's 5 pills, 2 could kill you, 3 could get you high, seems like an easy no for most of us. But what happens in the mind of an addicted person when considering this type of risk?
So I've talked with many people that are actively seeking and using and admittedly are addicted to fentanyl. And the drug is so powerful that they believe that they will die without it. They've told me, I cannot seek services. I cannot get clean because if I don't have fentanyl, I will die. Mm. So given that situation, that person that's presented with 5 pills and they know, most fentanyl addicts know that it's deadly, they will take the drug because they're going to die without it. They believe that.
Dr. Spencer, your thoughts there?
So, you know, one of the things I think, especially when we think about people starting these drugs, is that a lot of people's first exposure, you know, the most common story that I hear when people come to my clinic and I say, tell me about, you know, your history of like, how'd you start using opioids? And more than half of the time, it's a doctor prescribed it to them. And so, you know, we have, you know, many people can have a prescription for an opioid for a broken leg, a surgery, and, you know, they can take it for a few days, throw the rest away. They don't think twice about it. But when someone has a brain that is vulnerable to developing a substance use disorder, and that can be because it runs in their family, that can be because they experienced childhood trauma, they have mental health disorders, they have other chronic pain and other things in their environment that make them susceptible to developing addiction. When they take that same course of prescription opioids, can very quickly realize, wow, this actually makes me feel so much better. It relieves, you know, opioids relieve not just physical, but psychological pain. A lot of people don't think about that. They make, you know, all these horrible things in your life seem like they're better and you know, you can get through life. And so, you know, drug use is for a vast majority of people is a coping mechanism related to stressors, trauma, other chronic serious problems that people are dealing with. So the most people are, you know, yes, do kids hang out with their friends and take drugs recreationally? Absolutely. In every culture across the world, through all of time, people use drugs recreationally. But the problem we're really talking about here is the development of substance use disorder, which when you develop addiction, it takes over your brain and your life. And there's no logic behind it. You can't just say, I don't want to do this anymore and put it down. The definition of addiction is when you lose control of the substance, even though it's causing all these horrible problems to you and you know you should stop, you can't. No matter what you try, it feels like nothing works and you can't stop. So, but for a lot of people, you know, that experimentation is not, you know, here, try this opioid. It's going to be a lot of fun. Let's go party. It's, you know, hey, I have a very serious injury or illness. I'm taking this medication that's prescribed for a doctor. And that's when my brain latches onto that. It's like, this is the only thing that makes life seem like it's worth living. And then they can't let go of it.
Michael, pick it up there. In your work as a recovery specialist, how often do you see people who got addicted after an injury or illness that started with prescription medications?
Lori, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about the percentage of people that didn't get addicted because they had an injury. I'd like to talk about young people that are experimenting with drugs because of the adolescent age they are. My understanding is that 50% of youth don't understand the dangers of fentanyl and the illicit drugs. And unfortunately, the adolescent brain has this optimistic bias component that it won't happen to me. And there was a wonderful video called Cal's Story from the Beaverton School District, and Sandy knows Cal's parents, where this young man came home from school break, first year in college, was feeling a little anxious and got some Xanax online, and it happened to be contaminated with fentanyl. We have to let everybody know that every illicit drug out there, even Adderall, can be contaminated with fentanyl, and we know that, you know, just the amount that fits on the end of the tip of a pencil can be fatal, and we really have to get that message out to youth. I really believe that working upstream, that the work that Sandy's doing, is imperative to cut off the stream into the river of addiction. So we have two sides of this equation. We have people, as Sarah was mentioning, that get addicted because they had an injury, and then we have these other individuals, adolescents, that are experimenting. And Cal's father said the experimental drug game is over. It is opioid roulette, and the house always wins.
So awful. Such a terrible risk, especially as we know young people are online so much. And so to have that access is very, very scary and troubling. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Rob is in Juneau. Hello.
Hi, this is Rob in Juneau. I'm just, I heard the tired lie that marijuana leads to opioid addiction. We know the opioid crisis in this country was created by medical doctors and the pharmaceutical companies prescribing opioids to people. All the people I know that got hooked on opioids and led into drug addiction got prescribed those opioids from a medical doctor. And I'm really sad that somebody would say that marijuana leads to opioid addiction.
Sandy?
I agree that most people that were prescribed those opioids, my son included, ended up looking for drugs on the street. However, where we are in the world with fentanyl now, marijuana is more and more being laced with fentanyl to addict young people that smoke marijuana. They may or may not know that there's fentanyl laced in their marijuana. And so it's killing young people all around the country, including in Alaska, laced fentanyl in marijuana.
All right. Rob, thank you for the call. We are going to continue on with other callers. Todd is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I'm in Anchorage. Thanks. Good show. I am wondering, there's a type of fentanyl that's made, it's either called carfentanil or parafentanil, I forget, And I've heard it's like way stronger than fentanyl and it's harder to reverse and stuff. You guys have any insights about that, and especially in Alaska?
Yeah, I think you're referring to carfentanil. Sandy, you want to start us off and then we'll turn to Dr. Spencer?
Sadly, carfentanil is in Alaska. Recently, there's been a federal case of a young lady in Wasilla that was poisoned to death. She was 16 years old by carfentanil, and it's 100 times stronger than regular fentanyl. We talk about 10 grains of salt of fentanyl that will kill you. Carfentanil is 1 grain of salt that will kill you.
Dr. Spencer, are you seeing more of that more lethal compound?
So carfentanil hasn't been seen very often yet in Alaska. We see it occasionally. One of the ways we monitor or we get information about drug trends going on is actually through drug testing. So we can send off, for example, urine samples to, I'll send off some of my smart patients to be like, hey, let's look closer and see what is actually in the drug supply that you're using. And we can look for all these different, there are many different varieties of fentanyl. And carfentanil, it's quite rare in Alaska, but it can come up. The fact is that you have no idea what's in it. You know, there are, you know, it's probably some kind of fentanyl. You have no idea how strong, you have no idea how much. And so it's just really a gamble every time someone uses that there, you have no sense for, you know, how much is a safe amount to use, which makes it really difficult for people to make decisions, you know, safer decisions in their drug use when there's no way to know what's in it.
And Dr. Spencer, staying with you for a moment, I read recently that there are efforts underway to develop pain relieving medications that are less addictive. What are you seeing or hearing about this work?
You know, there was a medication recently approved by the FDA within about the last 6 months. That's a novel, meaning a brand new class of medication it's meant to treat acute pain, like in the hospital and post-surgery, that's non-opioid and non-addictive. I think a lot more, you know, we need to do more research into the treatment of pain. You know, the trouble, of course, with accessing pharmaceuticals is that brand new medications are often very cost prohibitive to use. So I think that, you know, it's important to have research in all the medical and non-pharmaceutical treatments of pain. We know in general the treatments that work best, especially for chronic pain and actually for many forms of acute pain, are non-opioid treatments. Actually are proven to work better. So it's an important area of research, but when the medication isn't affordable or widely accessible, which it isn't yet, it's hard to say whether it's going to really change that landscape. But in theory, if we could have a non-opioid medication that we could prescribe, even if it's just for acute pain, that we could maybe avoid triggering, you know, some of those folks who might be triggered by into addiction by the use of opioid medications. But it's a small chunk, you know, piece of the answer, perhaps.
Narcan, of course, is the treatment, the naloxone, the treatment of choice for first responders. But what else can people do if they don't have Narcan? What can people do to help keep someone alive until medical help arrives? Is there much that can be done?
If you don't have, so the thing that kills people when they have an overdose of opioids is not breathing. So if you are in the face of finding someone who is unresponsive and is not breathing, sometimes we don't know what's happened to them. We might suspect there's an overdose. Maybe you don't have Narcan. Routine like CPR and first aid is always the first thing that you should go to. If you have Narcan and suspect an overdose, you should give it immediately. But the thing is the person has to breathe to be alive. In like 4 minutes without oxygen and without breathing, you know, you can start to experience brain death. So rescue breathing is one of the most important things you can do after giving Narcan, or if you don't have Narcan, to help to keep that person alive until the ambulance gets there.
And as I mentioned, I carry Narcan kits in my car, my office. I carry them on the trails at night. The kits have disposable gloves in them. And I think that's something that is an important note about when you're administering this. You know, you're in a crisis. It's upsetting. Here's someone that is completely non-responsive. You're worried about them. But it is important to wear those gloves, correct?
So I think the gloves, there's also a CPR, sometimes a CPR, like a plastic CPR barrier to put over someone's mouth so you're not directly in contact with their mouth. So those are generally important for all first aid care for anyone, because that person, they may have vomited, they may have blood on them, they may have, you know, they're you know, one of the things those gloves are not in relation to is accidentally touching fentanyl and being poisoned with them. That is not what they're related to, and that's a huge myth around fentanyl, is that like just by being around it or by touching it you can overdose. That is not true, and that can help people be, that can make people scared of helping someone. So those gloves are in there because when someone has an overdose or any medical emergency, there can be bodily fluids such as blood, vomit, urine that you don't want to be touching, saliva. You don't want to touch those things, regardless of who you're helping in first aid situation. That's why those are in there. It's not actually to prevent people from like having an overdose themselves by touching fentanyl. That's a common myth around fentanyl.
That's interesting, because I had read about a law enforcement officer who overdosed while testing some compounds, and there was fentanyl in it.
You know, it's very, it's a kind of, you could read more into it, and there's a lot of actually some state governments that have put out advisories about the fact that almost always this is not true. And that's kind of getting into like all these other psychological things around the fear of these drugs. But in almost every case, you know, it just scientifically is proven to be generally not true. And but sharing those stories and sharing them over and over again causes a lot of fear mongering around, like, I can't even be around this. I don't want to be, you know, I'm gonna, and that's just not true. You're just, like, getting fentanyl on your skin or being around it is not going to cause an overdose. And that is a fault. And there are multiple governments that have issued like extensive information for law enforcement, public health, to debunk this myth. So I would try to look at some of those resources. And those are the resources I point people to, rather than the individual stories of the individual that experienced something, which there's lots of things that go into an individual's personal medical illness that happened to them on that day that we don't know about. And people share their stories about what might have gone on. But when you actually look at the population as a whole, the actual science behind it, that myth has been debunked. And so it's really important to not share those stories and to use instead like the government and scientific resources that talk about why those stories are harmful and not true.
We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. On the line with us is Dr. Sarah Spencer, an addiction medicine specialist who works for the Nanilchik Traditional Council. In the studio is Sandy Snodgrass. Sandy is a clinician and an anti-opioid activist. And on the line from the Valley is Michael Carson. Michael is a recovery specialist at My House of Mat-Su and chair of the Mat-Su Opioid Task Force. Corey emailed asking, how effective is a Narcan kit that has expired? So, you know, that's a great question, because, like I said, I got kits, I helped assemble them, I got some training, and I've been carrying them for quite a long time, and had those kits, I don't know, year and a half or so before I finally used one. Do they have an expiration that people should be concerned about?
They do have an expiration date on them, but it's widely known that they're effective for many years afterwards. So one of the things for professional organizations that need to keep all their medications under the expiration date is to distribute those expired naloxone kits to people that are, you know, on the street. Leave them in yards of people that you may suspect that are using. So that's what I do with mine. I throw them over the fence to people's houses that I'm pretty sure that's what they're doing in there, and get new ones. But don't ever just throw them away. Give them to someone.
That's a great idea. I know that I have given it to folks that have said, one young woman that I talked to on the trail who was very much in crisis, and I tried to get her to let me take her somewhere, but she didn't want to do that. But I did give her some Narcan and said, I hope that you never need this, but I suspect that you know folks that might. So, you know, take this with you, but please keep yourself safe. What, Michael, it can be difficult to get into recovery because of a lack of space or services. Tell us how services have changed in the last decade. Is it getting better or getting harder for people to access help?
I believe that there's been an improvement, and I know out in the Valley, the Opioid Task Force
had some initial top five priorities, and the first one was detox with dignity, shoring up treatment, and we were very fortunate that True North Recovery was able to open up Dylan's place. That was Karen Malcolm Smith's son. Then also Set Free Alaska was able to open up the Christopher Walden House of Hope, Dar Walden's son. So we have been fortunate out in the valley. But again, I want to let the audience know that they can go to Alaska211.org, and there are multiple listings. And one of the ones that we utilize is ARCH, run by Volunteers of America and Eagle River. And that's for adolescents. That's for under 18, for individuals that are seeking help for substance use disorders and co-occurring. So I believe that we are fortunate that probably, I know since the launch of the Opioid Task Force in 2016, we have seen a dramatic increase in treatment. And that is very, very fortunate for the state of Alaska.
And has the wait time between assessment and actually getting into treatment gotten better? Because I know at one point there's a long wait list.
Yes, I believe that, especially out in the valley with Dylan's Place and Christopher Walden House of Hope, they definitely look for that easy access, that open door policy. And then what is wonderful is they partner with other agencies in the valley. And if they don't have that, open door access that single day, they can make a phone call and, call down and find other treatment centers that might have that availability. Because we know, and both Sarah and Sandy know, that when that door or window opens, when the individual is ready to seek treatment, we have to be able to get that immediately, because the addiction can set in very quickly and shut that door down. So that same day access is imperative for us to have in the state of Alaska.
All right, let's hear another clip from the documentary Poison in Alaska that Sandy helped develop.
Treatment and stopping people from ever starting, beating the addiction before it starts, is the only cure that we're going to have to this. And this is not something that the Anchorage Police Department or the Alaska State Troopers can arrest our way out of. At the end of the day, we need help from mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters. We have to start it from ever starting. It's the only way we're going to beat this.
So it sounds a little bit fatalistic there. Do you agree with that? Certainly helping someone avoid addiction is the best thing, absolutely. But the comment sounds a bit hopeless for those who are already addicted. Give us some perspective here. Addiction is terrible, but people can and do relearn how to control their lives again, correct, Sandy?
People do recover. Michael said that very well. People do recover and change their lives. My concern and Captain Carson's concern is fentanyl. Fentanyl will kill you before you have a chance to recover. So he's speaking specifically about the world that we live in, the fentanyl world that we live in now, that it takes all three prongs of the stool. We need prevention, demand reduction. We need law enforcement. We need treatment. All three legs of the stool have to be pressed on equally or the stool falls over. Right now, the awareness, the education is not sufficient to meet the number of deaths that we're having in Alaska. We need more awareness, more demand reduction, more prevention. So that's what AK Fentanyl Response developed the film to do, is to take it to communities, to reach people, particularly in rural communities that are not aware of the dangers of the illicit drug supply in Alaska.
Is the opioid task force that was created in 2018 still active? Is it still being enforced or in use? I know that this was a result of then Governor Bill Walker declaring an opioid disaster declaration, an overdose disaster declaration in 2017, a huge and, a very serious and alarming declaration. Is that task force still in place?
What we did, Lori, was that we were able to meet those five top priorities, and we transitioned into a MATSU Youth Mental and Behavioral Health Task Force. We thought it was imperative to start moving upstream with prevention, because as many people have mentioned, that is the best way to avoid the disease of addiction. So we have launched that youth task force, and what we are looking at is creating a youth-centered community where youth are able to be connected to after-school programs, be able to find other like-minded youth, and also be able to create refusal skill statements if they are presented with drugs, because that will happen. So we are trying to help youth be able to avoid the pitfalls of addiction by moving upstream and as early as we can.
All right. And Sandy, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts about people in recovery and their long-term prospects for getting off of any kind of assistance and being completely sober. What are your thoughts about that?
So for me, the goal is to be off of any mind mood altering substances and to work. I am a member of the recovery community, and I believe peer-to-peer, the best solutions for me come from other people in recovery that have successfully not used or drank for many years and have developed a way to live in the world without drugs and alcohol with support from other people in recovery. So that's what works for me still today. 25 years later, I'm in very close contact with other people in recovery. It's a design for living for me. And I don't believe in taking any mind mood altering substances ultimately.
And Dr. Spencer, back to the treatment that you provide, the medicine assisted therapies, is your goal to help people make that transition so that they also are not using anything, so that they're less at risk of going back to using very dangerous, harmful drugs?
Yes. So we definitely talk with people. So first of all, you know, our main, every patient has different goals for themselves. But a lot of people, you know, their goals, they want to stay out of jail. They want to get a job. They want to be able to take care of their kids. They want to be able to have a good relationship with their spouse. And that how to get there is different for each different person because they're facing different challenges. I think addiction is a chronic disease and it affects the brain, and your brain is always looking for something else to latch onto. So we definitely warn people about that. You know, I definitely see on a regular basis people, you know, okay, we helped you, you know, we got to help people to stop using opioids, even though they were using other drugs. And the only drug I have a problem with is opioids, but then they stop using opioids and then they're looking for something else for that comfort to relieve their pain, to relieve their trauma, their, you know, whatever. And then they turn to meth, they turn to alcohol, and can develop a new addiction to the other problems. So we're always kind of helping people to monitor that and to try to stay safe and to avoid developing a new substance use disorder to another substance. It's always a risk.
All right. Thank you so much to my guest today, Dr. Sarah Spencer. And also in the studio with me today is Sandy Snodgrass, and Michael Carson was on the line from the Matsu Valley. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. The editor for the program is Annie Feit. And on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.